Thanks, James. So I'll just provide a little bit of background about what we're doing and why and how. So this is Zed Code as it stands at the moment with inspirational global cover. You can see that that wasn't where we spent a lot of our effort. So we released the first phase of the code, which is roughly the first half of it, in New York in May, so about 6 weeks ago or so. So let me just talk about how we got to where we are and why we're doing it. So on the why, it's basically reflecting the lack of trust in the FX market that's, I think, come to pass over going back a few years now, both between participants, but as much between the market and other, the public at large. So the BIS governors, just over a year ago, commissioned us, me and my colleagues, to come up or to develop a code of conduct working with the industry and also develop ways to get the industry to follow said code of conduct. Because as you all know, we've had codes of conduct in the industry for a while. Part of the problem is they've been codes rather than code, singular. But they've been there, and willfully or otherwise, they've been ignored at various times over the last few years. So anyway, we've been tasked to come up with this code, and the group who's putting it together, which I'm chairing, consists of the central banks, or the people who are basically head of markets at the central banks of the largest 15 currencies in the world. So that's both developed and emerging, includes China, Korea, India, and Mexico and Brazil from the sort of emerging side of things, as well as the major developed currency centers. But it also includes a group of market participants that David Puth from CLS, who I'm sure you all know, or as most people, it turns out, have actually worked for David or with David at some point in their life in the industry, as best as I can tell. So David's chairing this group of market participants, which is again drawn from around the world. It's also drawn, importantly, from the whole cross-section of the market. So it's got the sell side, obviously, it's got the buy side, and a reasonable representation across there in terms of corporates, asset managers. It's also got non-bank liquidity providers, including the people who, according to at least the Euromoney poll, number eight in terms of liquidity provision, which is XTX on the group. So we also have a few other non-bank liquidity providers there. We've got platforms. So Phil Weisberg from Reuters has been doing a lot of work on this and is currently doing a lot of work on drafting the code. So we've pretty much got the whole spectrum of the market represented and fairly evenly distributed both across the parts of the market and well in terms of role, but also across the globe. So we've got EM participants as well as developed market participants. In Australia, Hugh Killen from Westpac is on the group and has also done a hell of a lot of work over the past year and has a fair bit to do over the next year. So what we've done is we've put together this first phase of the code over the past year. We put it out for comment three or four times, got about 6,000-7,000 comments, which we considered and reflected in the draft. So we've given it a pretty wide circulation. If you have further comments of substance, we're still open, certainly willing to hear them. We've done the first phase of the code covered things like FX information sharing and execution, as well as confirmation and settlement. In terms of execution, it was very much around order handling, and in particular, acting as principal or agent or somewhere in between principal and agent, which is most of the market. And around information sharing, we picked that to wanted to do that one sooner rather than later and get stuff out there was because we general sense was, and including directly from us as central banks participating in the market, that information sharing had dried up. So having gone from a position where too much information was provided, given the uncertainty out there, a lot of participants had decided that the safe thing to do was to provide no information, and that was clearly impairing market functioning. So we felt it desirable to get some guidance out there as to what we regarded as appropriate guidelines for information sharing. And so that's in there in this first phase of the code. In the second phase, which is currently underway, and we're meeting in Frankfurt on Tuesday to flesh out exactly how we're going to cover some of these topics. The sort of interesting, the thing that most people are going to be interested in the second phase is the stuff we're doing around e-trading and around prime broking and around platforms, which is where Phil comes in. Appropriate guidelines for trading on platforms. So that work has commenced. We intend to have the first draft of the second phase out around the beginning of September for out to the market participants for comment. And then there will be similarly at least another two iterations for people to provide feedback on it before we sort of get to something which is close to final around about March next year. And then we're putting it out the whole shebang in May next year in London. At the same time as we've been putting the code together, we've been doing work on trying to work out mechanisms to get greater adherence to the code. And that's still very much a work in progress, and we're working with market participants on that, on some aspects of that at least. So this document isn't a legal document, so we're not regulators, most of us at least aren't. I'm not a regulator. Most of my central bank counterparts aren't regulators, a couple are. So it's a code of conduct, it's not legislation, or it's not regulation. It's very much principles-based, it's not rules-based. So if you read it, that's, I think, pretty apparent. So the question is, how do you get adherence to something like that? As I said, it doesn't have legal standing. So there are overriding motivation, I think, is to make sure that there are consequences from people not following the code. The one which tends to focus the mind the most tends to be financial consequences, I think. But they don't necessarily have to be negative financial consequences. Clearly, the odd billion-dollar fine has focused a few people's minds. They can also be positive as well. So there are basically three different legs to the adherence, at least as we have it at the moment. One is in terms of us as central banks participating in the market. And we've already said in May in New York that in our own trading activities with the market, we expect our counterparties to be adhering to the code. Similarly, in terms of membership of foreign exchange committees, we are looking at having that tied to adherence to the code. The foreign exchange committees themselves have already endorsed the code. The second leg is really around market-based adherence mechanisms. This is basically for the market, and so the market, we think, itself has a role in ensuring adherence, but in terms of the way market participants interact with each other. And the third is, while it's not regulation, we are certainly talking to regulators, including in this market, talking to ASIC, about how they might use the code in their oversight of market participants. That conversation has certainly happened already in London in terms of the FCA using this. So as I said, they're basically the three legs. We are still working out exactly the detail around that. We'll certainly have that out by the time we release the whole thing in May and give people some idea about how that's going ahead of that so that we can sort of hit the ground running following May. But as I said, this isn't regulation. It is principles-based, not rules-based. I've said on a number of occasions, I think the advantages of doing that is that if it's principles-based, it makes people think about what they're doing rather than just a box-ticking exercise. Similarly, if any of you have had the task of trying to write codes of conduct for your own internal or procedures manuals around conduct for your own firms, as soon as you start going down into the detail, it actually gets pretty complicated. And everyone comes up, well, what about this situation or what about that situation? And trying to be comprehensive and cover off anything is an impossible task. Also, the more precise you get, then someone has the incentive to say, well, if that's not explicitly prohibited, then it must be okay, which is not necessarily the way to get best practice in the industry, I think. If you make people think and discuss about how actually to implement the general principle, you might get the market to a better spot. So I said, the code is what it is. It's a principles-based code. It is not a procedures manual. How individual firms then incorporate that into their own practices, they may involve putting it into a procedures manual, but that's not what we're doing. So I said, they're the two main things. We're starting work on the second phase. The first phase is out there, easily found. You can find it on the Australian Foreign Exchange Committee's website, which is not too hard to find. As I said, we're still open for comment, particularly comments of substance where people think you've either got something not quite right here in a material way, or you've missed something. But we're commencing work on the second phase. People will start seeing what that's looking like around about September. And at the same time, as I said, we're moving forward on the adherence side. So let me finish there and head over to the on the couch or chairs.
Thanks very much, Guy. You mentioned at the beginning of your opening remarks that the code lacked a glossy cover. The good news is Thomson Reuters has prepared one with a glossy cover, which you'll all receive at some point in time, which really discusses the impact of the code on the buy side. So now I'd like to invite the panel to take their seats, please, and introduce John Noonan, who will be moderating the panel this evening. So many of you will know John. He's the Director of IFR Markets, Foreign Exchange Asia. John has over 30 years' experience in foreign exchange markets through analysis, trends, and the reporting of major events. And so he's extremely well-placed to moderate tonight's panel discussion.
John. Slipping off.
Well, thank you, James. I actually started in the foreign exchange market in 1973. It's probably a couple of you who probably weren't born then, I would imagine. But it's sort of Jurassic Park, and I'm not going to go down memory lane here. I'm actually going to lead to a question on this, but it was a completely different environment than it is today. It was the pre-bonus era. There were no systems. There was most deals were done by phone. Phones weren't recorded. Your word was your bond. The senior management of banks had no way of monitoring what was happening on a day-to-day basis. And believe it or not, there was not only wasn't there real-time, obviously, monitoring of trading, there wasn't even daily monitoring and trading. Revals were done once a month. And in those 20 or 22 trading days in between revals, senior managers of dealing rooms were the only source to senior management of information on how things were going, what was happening, were there any issues, were budgets being reached, et cetera, et cetera. And in terms of monitoring breaches, like banks would have overnight limits and dealing limits and how much they could do, they didn't have the systems in place to do that. They relied completely on the dealing room itself, the culture of the dealing room itself, the senior manager. To monitor that, because if you wanted to go outside your limit, the old tickets in the drawer, park positions with friends, square up and wait till 5 o'clock and reinstate positions. There was no way banks and institutions could handle that. And externally, and when you're dealing with your counterparties, again, there was no tapes on the phone, so you'd be calling up. You'd deal with brokers. Brokers at that time weren't taped either, and your word was your bond. Confirmations would happen at the end of the day. Sometimes it was a bit late, so we'll just confirm tomorrow. There were discrepancies, and they were always handled amicably because your reputation was everything. So it was a completely different environment, and codes were adhered to, and they may not have been written in stone, but for instance, you couldn't renege on trades. You had to because of your reputation, and there was incentive for being very, very straight and being very honest and forthright and credible, because senior management of banks relied on that, and so they rewarded that. So when you started out in the trading room, if you wanted to be promoted, if you wanted to stick around, they had to build this this sea of trust because they relied on you. And obviously that changed pretty drastically. Systems became better. They didn't have to rely on dealing room managers to work out what was going on, what the trading flows are. Systems would pop up any discrepancies. And, of course, the bonus came in, and the preference then was, well, it doesn't matter if your reputation is too bad, if you bend the rules a little bit, as long as you made a lot of money and you got paid big bonuses, really it didn't matter too much. It was okay to sail close to the wind. So the incentives have changed. And I think, sorry for the long-winded start, but my question I'm going to ask the panel in general is that, you know, putting in a code of conduct, single code of conduct, I think is a great idea. Obviously, there's been a tremendous amount of bad press for foreign exchange, and one has to be put out there. I think the culture has gone probably a little bit too far down the cowboy route at various stages, so I think it has to be brought back to that. But can it be done by, you know, threats alone of consequences, or does it have to be incentivized? In other words, should good behavior be rewarded as it was before the bonus culture, or is it even you can't reconcile it with the bonus culture? And so, Colin, would you have a comment on that?
I find it interesting that people will be rewarded for doing the right thing. That's maybe a stretch too far, but I do think that we need to get some sort of way, as Guy referred to, some teeth around the code. The sad fact of life is you've got to make people scared, and you've got to give them pause for thought, and you've got to come up with some way of actually doing that. You know, lest we forget, we've got two FX traders in court this week in London claiming unfair dismissal. We've just had another one, had a case resolved. These things are going to go on for months, and they reflect on the industry, on the organisation and the individual. So anything that brings some clarity should be welcomed. In terms of giving it teeth, I think a big part of that is the adherence. But, yeah, I think we can do it, and it has to be done probably on something like a demerit system.
What about you guys? Was it discussed with the various institutions that you...
It is, and it's currently under discussion. I mean, and reflected in the contribution that the market participants have made to the drafting of the code, there's a large number of people in the industry who are not happy with the public perception of the industry, who want to get it to a better place and are working very hard to get it to a better place. And so, you know, the incentive, the desire at least, not necessarily the incentive, the desire is there on the part of the bulk of market participants to do that. And they're happy to contribute to something like this, which has got some chance of doing it, which also means I think it's got, gives you, if there's a common understanding of what good practice is across the industry, it makes it easier to push back on practice which isn't good practice when you see it. Whereas I think in the past, some of it was just what were, coming to your description of the way it used to be, I think there was a reasonable commonality of understanding of what goes and what doesn't go. So one of the other things I think which was lost was that, a common understanding of what is appropriate practice and what's not. And what I think one of the things we're doing here is at least providing a focal point for people to, you know, regain some common understanding of what is appropriate practice.
And there's something else, John, something on top of that. You can, by actually giving it some, by getting the adherence piece right, you can protect the people in the industry that are doing the right thing. Because everyone out there is scared. You know, people are worried about, you know, can I say this? Can I do this? Yeah. And as Guy said, it's the market, to a degree, is ceasing to function. So therefore, by actually getting the adherence piece right and giving it some teeth so that you know you can go after the people that do wrong, you end up helping the people that are doing the right thing.
And it's certainly incentive for the large institutions. I mean, the ugly headlines and the, as Guy said, the billion-dollar checks they have to write out every once in a while is obviously giving them motivation to bring back the code and ethics. Les, if I could ask you, what is the challenges for implementing some of these codes? You know, putting them in systems, and what will the drain on resources be for monitoring ethics and codes, et cetera?
Sure. Well, from the buy side perspective, I think it's interesting to note that there's been many codes around for a long time. In fact, I think I was involved in a code that was introduced into the Australian market back in the 86 about confirmation of FX trades. So people have always tried to do the right thing. And I think to see the expansion of the requirements of model codes or global codes now is a good thing. And when I moved from the banking side to the buy side, I got involved with AIMA, who actually are introducing a number of sound practices codes globally. The issue, I suppose, from a buy side perspective, is the fact that you have to try and meet those codes on a regular basis because you're looking after other people's money. And other people come in and they perform a DDQ on you on a regular basis, and they ask you whether you are complying with those codes. And the penalty would be that if you weren't achieving what would be expected as best practice in relation to those codes, they would actually potentially redeem their investment in your fund, and there's a financial penalty there. One of the things is that as the codes have become more complex, obviously, with small hedge funds on the buy side and even some bigger hedge funds, is the fact that it takes a lot of resources to implement this and manage it. And unfortunately, at the moment, many of the codes are still in paper or PDFs or distributed in PDFs, so they tend to be something that's written. You receive, you understand, but there's a risk that it's put on a file or put on a shelf and it gathers dust, and people come along and say, do you adhere to that code? And you say yes, and it's basically a ticking of a box exercise. So I think, personally, that the fact is what we need to do with regards to these codes, which the buy side is very supportive of, whether they're issued by whatever authority, is the fact that we need to actually be able to manage it and implement it and monitor it and measure it. And how we digitise that is a question. Mm. But I think that's where we need to move to next. So there's many different codes. They're issued by many different authorities. And from a hedge fund perspective, you are, you know, I'm monitored by ASIC, I'm regulated by ASIC. And some of the aspects of ASIC's AFSL requirements on me mirror some of the things which are in the model code. Therefore, which one do I follow? And what would be nice is if I can consolidate that in some fashion, which is not an easy job. And if I could digitise it, and if I could manage it and have it affirmed automatically so people understood what they were doing, and if they didn't understand what they were doing, they had a resource of or a recourse to ask someone what they didn't understand. And when a review came around, I could provide them a digitised report rather than the panic of running around trying to find signed documents. And if something does go wrong, and someone did tick a box that they read and understood what they were supposed to be doing, I'm shifting the accountability to that individual rather than relying on a document that's written PDF style and filed on a shelf somewhere.
So can I pick up on a few of those things? So that is actually what we're trying to... The digitization thing is one thing we're actually looking at seriously. And I think there's some chance we'll have something along those lines as part of the adherence. So that is something we have thought about. The other thing, I think, partly coming to this point, is that we're... So one thing, at least on the FX industry, where, you know, it is moving from a number of codes into one, so not, that's not across the whole of FIC by any means, but at least for FX, you've got less to worry about, only one. And the other thing, another point I suppose to make is that one thing we've been stressed repeatedly is that to make sure that the code is applied proportionately. So not all of the code is relevant to all parts of the industry, and so it's a question of making sure that the parts which are applied appropriately, including if you're someone who only has a sporadic interaction with the market, what's required of you versus someone who's in there all day, every millisecond is slightly different, or is appropriately different, let me put it that way. There are some parts... but in saying that, what we're not saying is if you're only in there once a month but go in there and abuse the market once a month, that's bad, whichever way you look at it. So you're not just because you're only doing it one, you know, a few times a year, that's not too bad in the proportionality stakes. No, that's bad. So we're mindful of that. I suppose the other thing I would say is that we've gone... So this thing is short. It's only half of it, but it's the first half is short and the second half is also going to be pretty short. It doesn't actually take that long to read.
Yeah.
I've said on a number of occasions it's written in plain Australian, so it's not a, you know, an FX trader can understand it, I will assert.
Spot trader?
I've got Mr. Dolan here, and I've given it to him, and he can understand it, who's my FX trader. So there's no disrespect to Dave, but the, but you know, I would claim, although I would claim this because I wrote it, it's readable. So it's it's both readable and short, which I think gives it some more chance of actually being read, because we were very aware of some of the things you were saying, is that this is not something to go and sit there on a shelf.
No.
As Colin said, actually, he hadn't actually seen it in hard form in this before now, but that's only because I've hit print and printed it out, but it is actually an electronic document. And we are looking at ways that as this thing keeps on evolving, because it will need to keep on evolving as the industry continues to evolve, of basically having that being done electronically and with sort of digital ways of demonstrating adherence, which evolve with it in a way which is not going to imply too much of a sort of, want a better term, compliance burden on people.
Sure. I think nowadays, with the way digital technology is, that's much more achievable than what it was 15 or 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. And I think that's very important because not only does it allow people to review the code if they're required to affirm that they understand it, they can link to that code and read it, and then they actually affirm that they understand it, and then their management knows that they have read and understood. So if they do something, right, we all follow a code in Australia which is called the Highway Code, but we all know that we speed on occasions. This is actually saying to people, I don't speed, and they actually affirm that they don't speed. Now, they may speed, and they may just affirm that they don't speed, but at least that you know that they have read what they are supposed to do, and you has, as a manager, understood that you've done your due diligence on those individuals who work for you and understand what they are allowed to do and not allowed to do.
Now, on the consequences side of things, I mean, are they dealt with internally on recommendations of how they should be dealt with when there is a breach of conduct or poor behavior or ethics that aren't shown? Or is there an idea somewhere to have sort of a third party, you know, making judgment on line ball calls, or even looking through some of the examples that you gave for taking orders, and that's a big issue. Some of them are quite vague, not the way it's printed out, but I could imagine examples in my head where many interpretations could be made. How are those adjudicated?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I describe it as what we've done is we've made it clear that some stuff is clearly black and some stuff is clearly white.
Yeah.
But as you say, there's a fairly decently large chunk of grey, particularly in things like execution and information sharing, actually, in between, where it's not obvious. So I would say there are two things. One, both internal mechanisms, including for picking that up and dealing with it. But also, I think one thing we are working on is also external mechanisms, so whistleblowing of some sort or another. And then the question is to whom, and that is something which we're still working out. Colin said something like demerit points or something along those lines. So but you still need someone to assess whether it in demerit
which,
points
which can
or
build into an annual appraisal.
Pardon?
Which can be built into an annual appraisal.
Yeah, yeah. So that is something. You know, those are the issues which we're basically focusing on over the next six, 9 months. I mean, clearly, if it's something which is at odds with the local securities regulation, then that's straightforward. Mm. You know, in that situation, what happens then, everyone should be well and truly aware of, which that goes to the securities regulator. But if something like this, which is, as you said, it's you can think of examples which are, can go either way. I mean, some of that is as much coming down to having that discussion within the trading room or within with your own internal compliance and saying, okay, this is the way we think about it. It's not necessarily going to be one right answer to that.
Right.
So you're going to have errors, omissions, misconduct, gross misconduct.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe something like that. I mean, I think. And to that point, I mean, one of the things, if we see examples of non-adherence, I do not regard that as would not by any means regard that as a failure.
No.
If we see examples of non-adherence which are let go, that I would regard as a failure. But even self-identification of that, I would regard as a sign of success, not failure.
So in that instance, let's say you have errors which always occur, omissions, people forget to do something, or perhaps misconduct, which is picked up by senior management or management, and then gross misconduct. The individual who has done something wrong which is qualified as misconduct, if it's not acted upon, who's responsible? Is it the management or the individual?
Well, in the UK, that's now very clear because they have the senior managers regime and it's, you know, management is directly, you know.
And every senior manager is trying to get the hell out of it and the responsibility.
Yeah. But then that comes to, in part, the question of have you got the right, coming to something you said earlier, systems in place that you can say, okay, you know, in the end, I can't be completely responsible for someone going rogue, but I can at least ensure that I've conveyed to them at least the way we do things. And if they go completely at odds with that, amongst other things, I should at least have something in place which picks that up sooner rather than later. Not going to necessarily stop it, but I should at least be able to detect it.
The problem is, though, how do you deal with the commercial pressures?
Yeah.
Because somewhere down the line, this is going to go to someone in the business going to say, well, it's a bit of a grey area, but this customer pays us $4 million a year.
Hmm.
Do I really want to, you know, hack that customer off and risk losing that volume? That's going to be the real challenge within the business is, okay, is someone willing to turn around and risk potentially lucrative? And in some cases, it could even be, you know, dominating business in terms of a revenue stream.
Yeah,
no, I agree. That's very much the challenge.
Well, that would go to senior management because they'd have that decision on that basis.
Yeah, all of the guys in this room would know that there's a deal committee. So something of that nature would go to a deal committee. Senior management would look at it. You know, the guys in each of the firms here that have a presence in the UK or the US would know that they've signed up to certain senior management and executive regimes that they're liable, personally liable for. So there's a lot of that goes on, and they think a little bit more deeply these days about the decisions they make. And if it does come down to an inappropriate decision based on a $4 million customer versus, you know, $1 billion fine or personal liability, I know which one they'd be making today. So there's
What about if it's a grey area where they're not sure there's going to be a $1 billion fine?
There's always a reference. So there's always your compliance officers. There's always your in-house counsel, someone that you can refer to, even talking to the regulator if you have to, you know, just to seek advice if it gets that far or if you're really not sure. So I think it's not a one-man decision process as it probably was, you know, when we were sort of growing up in the markets, but it is very different these days. And I think that a guy who wants to make the decision by himself and possibly make the wrong one is slightly foolish in today's market.
Is that an error or an omission or is that misconduct?
Well, it depends what the issue is.
Yeah, I think that's where the grey area is. Someone may make a decision thinking they are doing the right thing and it's an error.
Mm. Yeah, but one of my answers to that, and it's not going to completely answer the question, is if you can come up with a reasonable justification for the decision you took, that's okay. It may not, you know, someone else may come up with a slightly different interpretation. Mm. Fine, but I think if you can provide a coherent story as to, you know. I mean, so one, you know, to pick one example, another thing I spent too much of my life on recently is around the fix, right? So if you decided that you were going to, so one of the things we recommended around the fix a few years back was, you know, people sort of charge appropriately for it. And mostly that's happened. And then to Cole's point, there's some chance of there sort of being a race to the bottom and those fees, you know, in a few years' time, those fees get competed back down to something close to nothing again. Well, okay, but then if a few years after that something goes wrong with the fix and then you turn up to your local regulator and have to explain, well, we just decided that actually in the end we could ignore that and start going back to not charging anyone for the fix again, it was like, well, good luck with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is not going to work well as any sort of ex post justification when there was clear, I think, guidance as to what was appropriate. If on the other, you know, if you're saying, well, we decide, we changed the way we did our execution of business through the fix, and we reckon a reasonable price for transfer of risk has gone from $20 a million down to 15. Fine. Yeah, that's a perfectly reasonable justification for that. So as I said, if you can make a reasonable case for something, say others might come to a different opinion around some of the grey stuff, but I think that puts you in a hell of a lot better position. Going to completely absolve you of everything versus sort of what I say broadly willful ignoring of stuff.
And part of what you're trying to achieve is to free the market up. And one of my concerns with Michael's point there is if we go into a process where lawyers are involved, it's never going to be a quick thing. Because they're, on the basis they're paid by the hour. So are we then going to free the business up? Well, I don't think we are. I think we're going to have a problem. Unless you can actually, I guess, take a specific issue, separate it, say, right, until that time.
Sure. I mean, you're playing at the edges, right at the edges here, I think. If you're going external, but most firms would have an internal counsel or someone they can refer to. It may not get to legal, but you've certainly got a risk and compliance officer that you can have a chat with or even your boss. So, if you've got a deal committee...
Is that risk and compliance officer going to be willing to actually make a decision?
No.
And I think this, this is partly the challenge that we face, in terms of implementation industry wide, is that somewhere down the line somebody's got to say, okay, I'll make the decision.
Sure. And that's what people are paid for as senior executives in organisations, ultimately. But again, as Guy said, you make a decision in good faith.
Yeah.
And you head down that path. If it is slightly grey, if you're really, really unsure, again, that's where you refer it up. But surely people are paid. They're senior executives. They've been around the traps a bit and they've seen a lot of scenarios that they can opine on. So, I understand the issue, and I'd say playing right at the edges, playing right to the rules until the referee tells you to stop, it's probably a little bit difficult to justify. But there might be a grey situation where you need to make a call.
So, therefore, do you think management needs to... And I'm talking senior management, maybe not necessarily the people in this room, but senior management needs to be able to give, part of their big task is to actually give confidence to their staff members that they can actually operate as normal. Take the fear factor out. We don't want everything escalated.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. But it is business as usual. But the guidance and the principles are what provides the confidence. Right? So you're working within the guidelines. If you provide specifics, then I think people can play to those margins. And as said earlier, you can actually decide not to because it's not on the left-hand side of the road. It was actually on the right-hand side. And again, playing to the until the referee blows the whistle, that's a little bit off-piste. But again, I think it's about reasonability.
And of course, the first thing we're always taught when we're playing sport is play to the whistle.
I'm the compliance officer of my hedge fund, and I don't have confidence in myself to make that decision that you said other compliance officer. I mean, I have a mortgage, I have kids. I'm not going to make that call. I mean, I'm just not going to make it, right? Why should I make it? I'm going to look for someone else to have that responsibility. I mean, I'm not the guy at the front office making the big bonus if the trade's done. I'm just getting the pay. I'm just actually paying my mortgage off.
Yeah.
If you come to me and say, I want to do this, and you better make that decision now. It's like being in the back office 25 years ago when a deal used to come out to you and say, you need to confirm that deal now because my bonus depends on it. Not going to do it.
Right, but then I still think, as Michael said, there's ultimately someone who's in the organisation who's got to be accountable. I mean, the other thing also, I think a lot of what this is, so there will be stuff like that which is at the margins, as Michael said, but the bulk of stuff actually, and some of the stuff we're providing is around just regular operation and making it clearer to people that this is sort of what goes. Yeah. And also, as I said earlier, I think a common understanding of what goes rather than a whole bunch of varied understanding.
I think that's a key point, actually. I think we've got a code here which is excellent, and I don't think we should look at reasons for not following it. I think we should actually follow it, and if there are things on the edges, fix it later, rather than actually not do it because some of it's too hard. Mm. I think that's the point. I think you're never going to get 100% perfect every time, but if you look at what was done 25 years ago, I remember being beaten up by the ABA in 1986 asking the banks to confirm foreign exchange trades against each other. Things have changed substantially, and in 5 years' time, things will change substantially more. So I think We don't want to push back on the code on the basis that some of the things are hard. Mm. I think those things that are hard, put them on the side, don't restrict business, but follow what you can follow.
And the clarity is very, very good. Yeah. You know, and I found it significant in one of the judgments of one of the unfair dismissal trials in London. The judge stated explicitly that in a given date in 2013, all staff were told this behaviour was inappropriate. And from that moment on, there was not one instance of that behaviour. But they just weren't. It wasn't clear to them before. So, providing clarity, is a huge step forward.
And the demerit point you mentioned about before, you know, I think that's important. Mm. If you get a demerit point in one organisation, you go to another organisation, you've got 5 demerit points. Mm. It's like losing points on your licence. Yeah, I don't know how you actually implement that, but maybe that's.
But that's one of the questions we're trying to answer.
Yeah.
Also, too, looking at leading on from that, right at the ground level. And some of the examples you gave, again, order taking and handling of orders, takes a fair bit of sophistication because communication between a lot of clients want orders handled differently. There's no one or two or three ways to handle, whether it's stop loss orders or limit orders, take profit orders, large orders, whatever you want to call it. So they have to be able to communicate. It seems to be a stress on communication with the client, clear upfront, this is how we do our business, this is what we expect to, you know, make on it or how we're going to justify doing the deal. So obviously it's going to have to be a fair bit of education and training because that's, somebody with 1 year's experience who's been around the edges a little bit can't really, that's a pretty sophisticated communication that has to be done.
Yeah, I mean, so that's partly why we do things like this, I mean, to be honest. But, you know, there are a few education offerings out there. James mentioned one at the beginning, which in this market, and there's obviously we're not going to endorse any one particular model on that front, but there's one or two of them out there, but they are looking to build off of what we've got. I think there is a decent education process to get out there so that people understand it. The other thing, picking up on one of the other things you just said, then is that. Part of the other thing is that if a client comes to you and asks to handle an order in a way which is at odds with what we've got here, it's also to give you the confidence to push back and say, no, actually, that's not appropriate way to do that. And then rather than in the past, possibly, that person may have just gone down to the next firm down the road and said, yep, sure, I'll do that. It gives you a little more confidence that actually they can't do that, and they can't go to the next person down the road because they'll get the same response. So it's as much an expectation, and it may well be that the client is asking something in complete ignorance, and in which case,
you're educating him.
You're educating the client. By the way, the numbers belie this, but there are female participants in the market, and so we should it's been a very him/her guy.
Oh, right, sorry.
Anyway, so. One of the other things we're trying to do is, it slightly gets to the culture of the market, I think, which is changing a bit anyway.
Well, one thing that you didn't stress tonight that you have previously is that this applies to everybody in the foreign exchange industry, and that involves clients. And I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that have experienced certain slightly large buy-side clients who always want to know everything about your order book. But as long as you don't tell anybody else about what their orders are with you.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's as old as the hills, So we've got to educate some very big and experienced clients that actually, no, we can't do this anymore.
Yeah, but I think that's sort of going okay. Because that message is getting out there. Because I think actually over the last couple of years it's been the opposite, that the information flow has dried up pretty much to nothing. And it's more saying, actually, there is some stuff which is useful to convey to people to give some idea of, to help market functioning. Because another question we often get asked is whether, a code of conduct is going to worsen conditions in the market. And I say, no, what we're trying to do is actually make conditions better than what they've been over the last few years. And by giving people a bit of clarity about what goes and what doesn't, and actually trying to address some of the dysfunction in the market that's occurred in recent years, as people have got the sort of fear that some of you have mentioned earlier.
Colin, a question for you. we were talking about it the other day, and Guy referenced it earlier about stage two. There's going to be another, well, May next year and whatnot. What do you consider to be the key challenges for stage two?
I think the key challenges are around adherence and electronic trading. It may sound slightly strange, but I don't think the problem in our industry going forward is going to be with the banks. I think the banks are pretty much on the side. They've all taken their $10 billion shock to the system. The adherence codes within the banks that I'm speaking to are a lot stricter than the code of conduct. You know, and as Guy said before, this is a baseline for conduct. I think the real challenge is how do we reach the smaller players in the industry, so maybe in the fringes of the industry, as you know, to Michael's point. How do we reach the archetypal four guys in a garage in Nowheresville, Arizona, who are latency arbing the hell out of the market via CME and EBS, just by virtue of where their servers are located? Getting to those guys, I think, is a real challenge. The PBs can play a role, but I also think the platforms can play a role as well. Because obviously so much of this trading is anonymous.
That's right.
So how do you know, as a liquidity provider, that your counterparty is abusing the hell out of you? How do you know who they are? So I think maybe somewhere down the line, this is where the platforms have to maybe step up and take more responsibility and say, okay, we are going to monitor behaviour much more strictly on our platform. And one of the punishments could be you will be identified.
Yeah.
If you break the rules, you will be identified to all LPs.
Well,
the challenge will actually be for some of the smaller platforms, because all of a sudden they're talking about putting in a big compliance unit.
Yeah, but so, I mean, my vision, which may be a pie in the sky one, is that I don't think you're not going to completely eliminate that. But if you have some core of the market where people can be confident that this is the way the market's going to function, and hopefully that core's reasonably large, it's not going to be every single platform out there. But if you're pushing that behaviour to the frontiers where they sit there and pick each other off, okay.
Yeah, and part of the problem is, though, Guy, that you've got...
The separation is nowhere near as seamless as...
Yeah, and the smaller firms typically are high frequency.
Yeah.
Especially in the States.
Yeah.
So actually they're a larger proportion of the market than maybe they would normally be.
But I still think it comes to your point. I mean, and that's one of the things we're picking up on in terms of the platforms, if you have these sort of rules of engagement, and we've already seen some rules of engagement on platforms where people will say, okay, if I monitor this sort of behaviour, then A, I'm going to start widening the spread on you, or B, I'll start randomising the price feed for you, or ultimately I'll just cut you off. You can do that.
Yeah, the platform can.
Yeah.
The LP can't, because a lot of times they have no idea who it is.
Well, yes, but that's right.
But
maybe also getting a slightly better idea as to who it is wouldn't go astray in some cases too. From the liquidity provider point of view, I think on the PB side of things, I mean, I think we're past, he says possibly wrong again, but I think we're past the day of, the flow monsters, at least as you said, certainly on the bank side of things, I think that's true. And so I think people care a little bit more about who they're actually providing the liquidity to than they did in the past. Now, as you said, it's more... whether that's true of some of the new entrants,
who actually go out there and say, I'm a non-bank market maker and I provide liquidity on a lowest cost basis.
Yeah.
Well, if they've suddenly got a compliance function, they've got a finance, it changes their entire business model. Are they going to be willing to make that step? And if so, how do we actually make sure they do?
Yeah.
But the prime brokers are already looking at who they've got on board.
Mm.
They are cutting quite a number of small players.
I don't think looking at it from a behaviour point of view, though.
Not necessarily, no, but there are indicators that would prevent some of these smaller places, the two men and a monkey sitting in a garage, it sort of takes them slightly out of play, and where do they go after that? So it is happening, and it's organic because people are aware of their own responsibilities. So it might start at the institutional level or interbank level out to the buy side, and we know that the buy side is some of the largest market makers in the market at the moment. So it does filter out and filters down, and the prime brokers are getting smart about their own responsibilities and how they should react. So I think there's some preventative measures that are going on. Everyone wants to be efficient. They're all talking about capital. They're all talking about the reputational issues as well as some of the litigation going on. So it's kind of, as I said, there's some stick, but there's also some carrot in terms of making them more efficient and So it does feed down the line, probably not as quickly as everyone wants, but it does happen. It's happening now, from what I'm seeing anyway.
As a platform provider, do you actually think that you know your industry generally will have to step up to the plate more? I know Reuters has an extensive rule book, and as Guy said, Phil's
all over
a big part on the committee, but I mean, do you actually think industry-wide?
Yeah, look, and I don't want to sit here, you know, spruiking our product. But what I would say is that you need to be ingrained in the market. So all the market governance committees, you need to be part of that. So you need to follow that. You need to understand what the best, I suppose, the best result for the market participants is as well. So if I'm going to support the market, then I better understand how it works and operate, and we better support it in the right way in terms of governance. We're not a governing body, and I don't think we ever would or should. But in terms of supporting the regulators and the market for its best interests, you know, that's what we should be doing. And the market should be doing that in general. You know, some of the fly-by-night smaller operators will have a problem because they can't look at the total environment and the operating environment. There are a lot of gaps and holes that they need to plug. And, again, they might be cheap, and that's fine. You can go with that. But, again, what are the consequences of making a mistake? And that's all I would say on that. And again, it's not about spruiking product or talking my own book. However, people need to consider that and be very careful.
I guess, you know, how you actually get the platforms in line, if actually, you know, all the platforms aligned into a similar standard, is going to be quite a big challenge because, you know, they're different models, but even if you just take the models, firms are different sizes. How do you get these guys, you know, everyone's coded in a different way?
This strikes me
you'd be having a lot more sleep this night.
Yeah, no, I'll have better answer that question in 2 months' time, I think, when we actually see what we've got. But we haven't just got Reuters and EBS working on this. Like, we do have them work, both Phil and Daryl Hooker working on it. But we've got some of the smaller platforms involved as well, so... Yeah, who do so? As I said, we're trying to make sure we've got those different perspectives reflected, so it can work for everyone. Not going to be something that everyone likes. Not by no means some sort of lowest common denominator outcome here, but at least have the input from everyone.
Yeah. What about and we discussed this when we were talking about what was it, a year and a half ago, the fixings. I mean, obviously, trading algorithms at banks and institutions. Playing a greater role every day, whether it's on handling orders, et cetera, et cetera. So you can put down, you know, ethical rules on how they should, you know, what's gaming the market, what's allowable and what's gaming the market where you're actually working the worst interest of the client, et cetera, et cetera. How is that monitored with trading algorithms, which can be, I would think, programmed to game the markets or game orders?
You actually monitor algorithms with algorithms, actually. No, I mean, I say that in all seriousness.
Yeah, I know. That's your problem.
I mean, that's sort of the compliance you put in around that. And in the end, I still think what applies to an algorithm applies to a trader, right? An algorithm's a fast trader. Right?
Yeah.
So it's still, in the end, at the bottom of it is a trade or an execution method, which has got to be consistent regardless of the speed at which that actually occurs. So, just because it's an algo doesn't strike me as being anything particularly different. I mean, we've seen around the monitoring, and particularly on the PB side, one of the main things they've got to have is some way of monitoring the liquidity provision so that, you know, their credit restrictions aren't being breached, or if something goes rogue, you can kill it quick enough. So the sort of monitoring there is already in place at really high speed with kill switches in, hopefully, which work in place as well.
It's a very difficult area because if you look at what's happening in the US with the CFTC, are trying to bring in this Reg AT.
Yeah.
And they're after the firm's source code.
Yeah.
Well, okay, in the US, there'll undoubtedly be a massive court case which will go on for years before they win or lose that demand. But it strikes me that you can give up your source code to someone and go back and get your bloke in wherever he's sitting and say, just pull that trap back in again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think we need to be worrying more about should we be putting in standardised rules around last look and round trip times rather than actually how the algo's behaving. Because an algo can go rogue, and as Guy says, you should have kill switches in place, but accidents will happen. So to me, I think, yeah, the algos monitor algos, but generally speaking, someone has written the code for that algo. And as we found out last year with one institution, you know, their code basically was not so much abusing last look, but they weren't exactly straightforward with how they used last look.
Is that, I mean, what is the solution for last look and
I think it's getting to the people who are writing the code and saying, by the way, this code of conduct adheres to you as well.
Yeah. But, I mean, last look, which is something we are, have said on any number of times, going to have something to say about. I mean, I still, it's more defining what, you know, I've heard everyone has provided their opinion on last look, including our friend here, over a long period of time. And I think it's more just giving, you know, I'm pretty confident, without completely committing it, we are not going to say there shall never be last look by any means. It's like, you know, there is a time and a place for it, and there's a way to do it and a way not to do it. And that's what I'm pretty confident we're going to say.
And transparency on how they do it.
Yes. Well, there's transparency on how to do it, and then, as has come to light in a couple of cases, having said this is what you're going to do, then actually doing it is also not a bad thing to do.
Yeah.
Don't think you needed a code of conduct necessarily to have that one, but anyway. Which have been partly, I mean, people read this stuff and say, well, isn't this a whole bunch of motherhood statements? And there are indeed a decent chunk of motherhood statements in there, but apparently some people needed to be reminded of these motherhood statements. You know, there's a lot of common sense there, but which mostly is just common sense, but apparently that wasn't common to everyone's sense.
The reason we need a single code is because financial markets generally, or the participants within them, have short memories. So we need somebody to be able to turn around and go, just in case you're thinking of forgetting, in very simple terms, there's 76 pages that you should read again. Because, you know, these things do come around in cycles.
So it's like a knowledge database, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it's replacing a lot of different codes that were coming out of different organisations and different centers.
Yeah, I mean, in a sort of strict, you know, you've got the NIPS code in London, the one in New York, the ACI code, and then the Hong Kong and Singapore both have theirs as well. So it's replacing, it's a linear combination of all of those. I mean, almost in a strict, direct sense, plus a bit more.
Yeah. Well, I think for organisations like ACI, they now shift their focus from actually providing the code to providing some sort of monitoring and certification, as Les referred to and as Guy said there, in terms of digitalising the learning around it. I think organisations like ACI should maybe be focusing more on there. And to give ACI their plug, they've got this ELAC system, which does exactly that. So, you know, they're one of the several firms.
I'll let you do that plug. I can't.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, so it just dawned on me they're actually, like, you know, behind this as well. Yeah.
Yes.
No, so they've got their ELAC. So organisations like that and the FX committees can turn around and say, you will not be a member of this committee unless you adhere to this code. You know, it's a slight change of focus from providing the code to actually ensure it or help into ensuring adherence.
Yeah, I think one thing, being one of probably the older gentlemen on this panel, being in the industry for a long time looking at codes as they've developed over many years, you know, back in the 80s, one of my dreams was to actually have control processes in relation to the front office and the back office, because I moved from the front office to the back office. And you know, things like codes, the model code, the global code, or sound practices issued by AIMA, facilitate that. But I think what we have to be careful of, and you told me a story the other day about a particular bank in London who actually had a dealing room planned, and they couldn't move into it because three floors were taken up by compliance managers and there was no room for the traders. I think we need to avoid that. Somehow we need to avoid that. We can't see this model code as being another opportunity for banks to go and employ numerous amounts of compliance officers, and that's my apologies for any compliance managers out there. It's not a criticism of what the importance of compliance is.
That was insincere, by the way.
But I think we have to be careful of that, the fact that these codes are there for a purpose, and we cannot use them to suffocate business. And that's why I think it's important to move to what we said about digitising. And I think that's a role for people like Reuters and other industries out there of the digital age. And I know Reuters do certain things in relation to personal trading, in relation to hedge funds and regulatory processes within hedge funds, which is very beneficial. But I think that's what we need to do. We need to take these codes on. We used to use them as what they are there for, which is an education and a process of monitoring and assisting senior managers to monitor their trading exposures or their dealing exposures. But it's not an excuse to put layers and layers and layers of controls and compliance in, which will substantially suffocate business.
To be fair to the industry, there are initiatives already out there that allow people to monitor in real time. You know, stuff that happens over Reuters messaging, yeah, for instance. You know, they'll pick out words. You know, I was speaking to someone the other day, they're like, you know, if someone suddenly comes up with the word asparagus in the middle of a sentence,
word what?
Why is that person using that word? Asparagus. Why is that person using that word? Because it's out of context. So these monitorings, this monitoring technology can pick up on, you know, pattern or out of pattern recognition. So I think the industry is actually making a start towards that. So, yeah, with all due disrespect to the compliance officers out there, you know, hopefully the three floors in that centre will be replaced by people in the trading area again in a couple of years' time.
Okay. Well, unless anybody else has anything to say, we open the floor to questions. Then thank the panel for some very great insight before we do. Okay. So there's a microphone. There's microphones, I think, wandering around. If anybody has a question, please raise the hand.
Something smelly. Something smelly.
I've run out. There's one.
Hi, John Chase from ANZ. Not quite starting in 73, but 83, John. Look, I think the panel's given a great oversight or insights, really, into, you know, all the big challenges that we're facing. I think someone described it really as, you know, this code's helping to sort of helping us down the highway. To me, I think we've probably had a major car crash between the way the over-the-counter market has been operating for, you know, 33 years since the float. In this country, and to the way that sort of the legislation, as Guy mentioned, and clearly the code is not there, is not the nirvana, and legislation obviously will still always rule. So I mean, I can ask a backward-looking question, I can ask a forward-looking question. I suppose if I ask a backward-looking question, I'm going to get caught into trouble, you know, in terms of probably trying to put Guy on the spot on a few things. So looking forward 10 years, and I think, you know, the last part of the discussion has really highlighted some of the real challenges of real-time compliance. And you're certainly seeing in the States some real rigour around that and the requirements and the penalties, and they're very severe. And we know in exchange-traded markets, that sort of requirement across, you know, different asset classes, commodities, et cetera, has been in futures markets is... It's extremely punitive in terms of lack of, you know, in any breach. So looking at the over-the-counter market, we've had the biggest market in the world, the $5.3 trillion market. Once we get the BIS update, we can change that number. But, you know, we've had the biggest market in the world, and I think probably, you know, a big car crash. And we've now got this industry grappling with the remains of the car crash. So what does the industry look like in 10 years? Are we still going to be talking about the grey? Unfortunately, we've got people younger than you and I, John, who are going to be joining the industry who probably won't like the grey. Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with that? And does that put at risk potentially the over-the-counter markets and we shift towards exchange-traded and we shift towards agency?
That's a really good question, and I had posed a few times before. I mean, one thing been at pains to stress is the difference between an OTC market and an exchange market. And I do think that FX could and should and will stay as an exchange market. So we as an OTC market. So we've seen much more agency business. Agency business has grown a lot, actually, particularly around the fix. That's the most obvious, to me at least, part of the business, which has shifted to more agency. But and in some chunk of that, that is actually, you can see how that agency actually works for that. And there are some offerings out there around the fix which do make it look a little bit more like an that time of day look a bit more like an exchange rather than OTC. But for, I think for the in the interest of the client, as much as anything, the market does need to stay as an OTC market just because of the nature, the underlying nature of what it is. And one of the things we have, as we have been trying to stress, is this is different. It is an OTC market, and trying to regulate it like an exchange market is not going to be good. And hence, one of the things, motivations for the work we're doing is saying, if someone did go down the route of trying to regulate this like an exchange market, this is not going to go well. And you really, really, you, the market, really, really aren't going to like that. And so I think that's one of the other motivations for the, us working with the market to get what we get. If we can make that work, then that stops the market shifting in a direction which I think would be unfortunate, both for the market participants themselves, but in particular, in the end user of the market, who's going to get find life a lot worse in that state of affairs. And so I hope that we don't end up with FX shifting to an exchange-type model, because I think it would be an inferior situation to what we've got now. And the other thing I always, when people say, oh, well, what's wrong with that? I'll say, well, if I look at an exchange, US equity market, there's a nice exchange-based market for you. Doesn't seem to me to be working incredibly well all the time. You know, there is the odd problem around in an exchange market as well. So exchange is hardly the solution to all market functioning problems either. And as I said, in the FX market, I think it takes it to a much worse place.
So I was going to say car crash. I mean, look at, I can name three car crashes in the non-FX market, which are probably well known to everyone, which is Barings, SocGen and UBS, all in relation to futures, which is an exchange market. Mm. So I think car crash is a bit of a hard call on the FX market. I mean, I know there's some issues there, but if you were to go back to those colossal losses for those banks in the past, most of them were on exchange-traded instruments. Mm.
The point I would make is that I think it will stay OTC just to build on what Guy said, because the end-user customers, the people that actually are important to the people in this room, the corporations, the asset managers, what we call the real end user, they don't want to trade on the exchange because it's too transparent for their business. They're trying to put through large tickets. We've taught them to maybe break it down into smaller tickets and to maybe use an algo. Mm. But the fact is, on the exchange, that's very, very easily spotted. A question I'm fond of asking my friends in the US whenever I go over there is, if the US equity market structure is so great, why is 30%... a volume through a dark pool, because people don't want their business. So I think for the end, I don't think it'll be driven by anyone in this room as such. It'll be driven by the end user, the corporations and the asset managers saying, no, I do not want to go down the exchange route. I need delivery, so I don't want the clearing piece anyway, and I want guaranteed liquidity. I want risk transfer. The other point I guess I'll add is, I think there's a real danger, one of the biggest dangers to the OTC market, John, is what happens if everybody goes agency? I see more and more banks saying we're going to go agency in a very discreet way, but banks in the top 10 by Euromoney standards are pretty much saying we're agency. I went into one bank in February in London and sat down and they said, OK, here's so-and-so from New York via the video link. He's our global head of equities. He's going to explain our FX strategy to you. And I put my pen down and went, well, I think I know what your strategy is. And so that to me is a bigger problem. What happens if everybody goes agency?
Yeah, look, I think in 10 years' time, it's generational. You know, we'll all be, well, I'll speak for myself, but, be out of the game probably in 10 years' time. And it will be generational, and the impact of this car crash
will have faded. The scars will probably still be there, and it'll be folklore and all the rest of it, you know, as we've seen in the past. But I think the smart players will be looking at efficiencies, so further electronification. I think if you're smart, you'll be looking at how can you make your business more efficient and cheaper. You know, the funds will be looking at how can they split trades to 1,000 instead of 100. You know, you've got some of the larger funds saying, I've got problems splitting my orders to 100 sub-accounts, and that's a problem now. But so all these things in terms of efficiency and risk-weighted assets and all the capital allocation and the like will come into play. And the smart players in some of the other asset classes are already looking at it down to the desk. So in foreign exchange, you know, all this stuff will, you know, you'll be looking at your own book, thinking, how can I make this more efficient so that my margin, my profit at the end of the day is much better. So I think it's a generational change, and people will be more considered around their total 360-degree book as opposed to just the trades that they're doing and the risk on the top, and they'll be looking at the total efficiency of their business as they go forward. But again, you know, different regime. Mm. The market will evolve, and I think you see far more in the FX market and the OTC world anyway.
More or less humans.
Yeah.
That's the question I always
well,
ask. Well, I won't be here in 10 years, but...
There's more humans in foreign exchange now than there were 15 years ago.
I think the change will be that probably less on the machine, because there'll be less as they were doing trades and selling at the moment. There'll be more advisory. So there'll be more bespoke advisory. So it'll be a generational shift, right. And there'll be a change. And we've seen that in other asset classes already, so why not FX? You know, it's perfect for over-the-counter, of course, right? But also it's perfect for this you know, commoditisation in a slightly different way going forward. So 10 years' time, we'll see a slightly different package of a product.
I'm slightly more worried about the fixed income market, which I know is slightly off-piste, but I think the fixed income market shift, market structure shift, is actually more worrying long-term than it is in foreign exchange.
OK, sorry. We have time for one more question. Anyone?
I want a beer.
Exhausted.
I think that's it. Well, thank you very much for attending here this evening, and thanks again to the panel. Thank you.